There is so much mortgage advice out there that is frankly, confidently wrong. And it drives me crazy because your home and how you pay it off has a huge impact on your financial future. It's a topic that gets a lot of views. So you get these gurus who are super keen to weigh in on it. And then you get terrible information about how to get mortgage ready, how to pay it off faster, and what actually gives you control instead of, you know, what just looks good on paper. And this is why it drives me crazy. If people follow bad advice on this, the cost isn't just money. It's your time, sometimes years of your life that didn't have to be lived under such pressure. And it can also be hundreds of thousands of dollars. So you know me. We've got to do what we can do here, and I've found someone who not only can help us figure out some smarter tactics, he's not scared to get real with us. Aaron Cattell, who you might also know as the Mortgage Man, is a mortgage advisor on the front lines, helping real people, getting real numbers, and seeing what's working now.
A bit of a trick that you could just, so instead of refixing a mortgage after a year, don't wait a day, get it going floating. Do a big lump sum if you massively got like some sort of inheritance or you, I don't know, want a scratchy or something like that. You could put it on that mortgage and then refix it the day after. And then you kind of get the best of both worlds.
We want to know what matters when you're trying to impress the bank and get approved for hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt.
The number of times people tell me, you know, I want to clean my bank statements. And I'm just kind of like, what makes you think that they're not clean? And they're like, oh, I spend money on, you know, Uber Eats, KFC. I go out too much. I just want to get my spending down. I'm like, the bank doesn't care about that stuff anymore.
Then onto the flip side, once you've got that mortgage, how do you get rid of it again as fast as possible?
Loan structure is 100 times more important than just the cheapest interest rate is what your mindset should be. Not today, the cheapest interest rate. What is it going to be in 3 years?
We're going to cut through the mortgage myths that cost people years of their lives so that you can feel in control on one of the biggest financial decisions that most people will make. So, welcome to Making Sense. It's the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee. I'm Frances Cook, a financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. Aaron? Welcome to the podcast. So great to have you on. You and I have been following each other online for a little while, and I think you have such great chat that makes the mortgage world make sense because all of money and life interact, right? This is why we care about money. It helps you build a good life. But I think your home is this particular area where the overlap between money and life is so important, and yet it can get complicated, right? So when you see people and they're coming to you and chatting about it, what sort of life impacts can it have as they're trying to figure out the money side of the mortgage?
I mean, it's probably the biggest expense they have, right? And biggest purchase. So, you know, they're extremely nervous about going into buying a house, and a mortgage is something that they or some people obsess over. And because of that, it maybe sometimes takes joy away from celebrating that they bought a house, which is a massive achievement. For good reason, they should be looking into how they can save interest and how to structure a mortgage, how to buy a house, all of that stuff. But sometimes I think people focus on the wrong things.
Well, yeah, run us through some of those. When people first come in for that chat with you, are there any myths that usually pop up straight away?
When it comes to like the deposit size, a lot of people still think you need 20% deposit to buy a house in New Zealand, which you can buy with as small as 5%, depending if you go through like Kangaroo's first home partnership thing, or just some banks do 5% deposits, which whether or not you should buy with 5% deposit is a whole nother conversation because of the interest rates that come with it and the repayments. But for a lot of people, that might be a good option if they just want to buy a house sooner and don't want to rent. Another misconception is probably around how to actually buy a house. Like I have two extreme opposites that usually come see me. They either call me after they've already made an offer and it's been accepted and they haven't really talked to anyone, talked to a lawyer. And I'm just like, okay, hopefully
that's terrifying.
Hopefully this works. And that's the flip side of, you know, they are well ahead of where they think they should be. You know, I think a recent one, maybe in the last couple of years, is the making sure you have really clean bank statements.
Yes.
Because of that triple CFA rule that was brought in and then it was removed. The number of times people tell me, you know, I want to clean my bank statements. And I'm just kind of like, what makes you think that they're not clean? And they're like, oh, I spend money on, you know, Uber Eats, KFC. I go out too much. I just want to get my spending down. I'm like, the bank doesn't care about that stuff anymore. Like, if you gamble, if you don't pay your debts on time, if you do cash advances from your credit cards, yes, the bank will care. But not if you use Uber Eats every day. Like, we got a mortgage for someone that did Uber Eats for lunch and dinner every single day. And because the numbers worked and the bank understands that's discretionary spending, still works, still got approved, bought a house.
I put out heaps of content on that, you know, clean up your bank accounts at the time that the triple CFA rules were in place. Because when that first came in, it was so strict and the banks went so conservative and people did get declined. Thankfully, for once, sense prevailed and politicians intervened and changed things up and made it make more sense again, because that was a ridiculous, unworkable system. But it is interesting, isn't it, where you can have these myths. There are some myths that are just untrue, and then there are some myths that were true but are no longer. And you would also get some myths coming from overseas, because there's now so many people get financial content from, say, the US. Very different system from ours. Australia, much more similar. But, you know, you have to be careful about where you're getting the information from and does it apply here where I am. And I think particularly for lending, particularly for property, New Zealand can be quite its own beast sometimes. So if we stick with first home buyers for a moment, and we'll get to sort of the regular mortgage holders soon and how you can smash that mortgage once you've got it. But if we stick with first home buyers for a moment and talk about that lower deposit lending, because you made a point there briefly, which I think is really good. You can get a lower deposit. And that has been the problem for so many people. When houses are really expensive, it's hard to just pay for it. Even if you're doing so well at paying rent every single week, you're an angel. It's the saving up the deposit. So if you can get a 5, 10, 15% deposit, you don't have to hit that 20%. What are some of the rules around that? What are the pros and the cons? Because there are other little snags around that, right?
Probably the biggest one is interest rates. So 20% is the golden goose. You get the special interest rates that you see advertised, maybe a little bit cheaper. So right now, 1 year is like 4.49%. If you have a 10% deposit, you're not going to get 4.49% unless you maybe bought a new build and went to one specific bank who give discounts for new builds. Otherwise, you're going to get a margin added on. And that's basically a little increase in your interest rate temporarily until you reach that 20% equity mark. So the margin usually when you have a 10% deposit is 0.75 added on to whatever interest rate you would have got if you had the 20% deposit. If you have 15% deposit, it's usually 0.25 or 0.35 depending on the bank. Then you think about the 5% deposit holders. And you can kind of go to one bank that will just be like, we're going to add 1.25% on top. And you're like, oh, that's probably not worth buying because that's quite a big jump. That's like a 5.75% interest rate. Or you go through Kangaroa, which is their first home partnership kind of, or first home loan product, which allows you to still get those special interest rates. So 4.5% with 5% deposit, which sounds pretty good. But they then add what is called a lender's mortgage insurance on top of your mortgage. So that currently is 1.2% of the loan amount added to your mortgage. So if you're borrowing $500,000, 1.2%, so that's like $6,000 added on top that you'd pay off over that 30-year mortgage term. So if you're in a position where maybe you're tossing up between 5% deposit, 10% deposit, you need to see, are you eligible for the, you know, the Kangaroa stuff, because that's a really easy decision if you're not eligible. So interest rates is a big one. And then the need for a registered valuation. So if you want to buy a house, depending on what you're buying, sometimes the bank will want a valuer to go out to the property to check that it's worth what you're paying for it. And if you've got less than 20% deposit, the bank sees you as a risky borrower. So they'll be like, let's send this valuer out through our bank approved channels, not just your mate down the road, to make sure they increase the value. This person will come look at the property, compare it to other properties and say, you know, we think it's worth exactly what you're paying for it, or we think it's worth less, or we think it's worth more. And that kind of is an important piece of your due diligence because it can slow down your offer. And if you wanted to bid at auction, it has to be done before you bid. And that's a very common thing that people get tripped up by, because auctions, you have to do everything first. And if those valuations cost $1,000 each time just to bid, then that's kind of not a property you maybe not want to go for as a first-time buyer. Maybe you want to go for one via negotiation, can make your offer conditional on that, but it still has to be done if you're buying with less than 20% deposit, or if you're buying a new build, or if you're buying something that the bank thinks you're overpaying on. And then the pre-approval rules. So a lot of banks will say at the moment, if you've got less than 20% deposit, we're not going to give you a pre-approval, but we'll look at your application if you've got a live deal. So ideally, as a purchaser, especially as a nervous first home buyer, you probably want the bank on your side to say, hey, we're going to give you X amount of dollars. But that may not be possible when you have less than 20% deposit.
To my mind, if you're struggling with the deposit, many situations, it would make sense to do what you can to get that low deposit lending over the line and then pay that off as fast as you can to get to that 20% level. And then hopefully renegotiate, but get better deal on the interest rate, that sort of thing. Because if you're going to try and save so much in that time anyway, I feel like for a lot of people, the numbers work out and it's more of a sure thing. You don't know what the property market's going to do in that time, right?
Yeah. You have to think, like obviously a lot of people that listen to your stuff, they see how do I make more money? How do I earn more money? But you also have to realize that this is a home. And sometimes that is not the best financial decision to buy a home to live in, but you buy it for other reasons. You know, like if buying with a 10% deposit means that you can buy a house, that you can make your home, live in it, create memories, like is it really the worst thing in the world that you have to pay a slightly higher interest rate for like the first 1 or 2 years? I don't think it is.
Let's talk about that point a little bit more, because you've just thrown out a very interesting debate. You know, is it the best idea buying your own home to live in it financially? Do you ever have to run those numbers with people? Are there times when people are doing things right on paper, but it might not actually be the best thing for their life or their finances? Do you run into that?
Yeah, I think there's the people that are very money focused and they're like, I don't want to buy a house to live in because it doesn't make financial sense. I would rather rent.
In what times would it not make financial sense?
So a lot of the stuff that I see is, are the mortgage costs more than the rent for that same property in today's market? And in most cases, probably it would. If you buy a $1 million house today, it's not going to rent for the same amount that your mortgage would cost from day one. So people have that mindset, oh, it's cheaper to rent. And today, if you took a snapshot for that property, then yeah, you might be right. But people forget about there's this thing called the future. Yeah. And, you know, if we look back at house prices 20 years ago and rental prices 20 years ago, rent typically always goes up. House prices typically go up. But if you locked in a mortgage on a property 20 years ago, interest rates have always kind of just stayed between like 2.5 and 7%. So yes, they're going to increase and decrease over that time, but they're not going to go up on the same kind of angle as rent. Mm. So you have to think that by locking in the mortgage today versus renting for the next 20 years, like rent is only going to get more expensive, whereas if I just pay 5% on that mortgage, the repayment's going to be the same. If I increase my extra payments, it's going to be gone faster. So I think people have like, what's the best place to put my money? I would invest the rest, you know, in a managed fund at 10% or whatever, but you still need a place to live, and that place that you're living in just so happens to also go up in value.
Exactly. Yeah. You're locking in that price at a certain point in time. And I just think that is something that, particularly if you're in your 20s, even if you take the standard 30-year time to pay off a mortgage, that's, you know, often a pretty good deal. Pay it off even faster, that's even better of a deal, but we'll come to that very soon. We talked a little bit about myths in terms of the stuff around from the CCCFA. I also see a lot of myths floating around, stuff that's often come from American content creators and things. Do you see any other myths like that as well that you'd like to take the opportunity to bust right now?
Yeah, I've got two. And I get asked every single day on one of them. Credit scores.
Oh, yeah.
So America and the UK, you know, you have to build up a credit score. You need to get debt and show the institutions that you can pay it off. Doesn't really work like that in New Zealand. You don't need to get debt and pay it off. You already have a like okay credit score. The bank doesn't really look so much at the credit score. They look at the faults. So you could still get a mortgage if you've never had a credit card or an Afterpay or anything like that. Like that's all good. Whereas like I talk to people that maybe have moved here from other countries. They're like, do I need to get a credit card so I can show the bank I can pay off a mortgage? And I'm like, no. Like as long as you haven't had a credit card and defaulted on it, then you're going to be okay. So the other one is that if you have your repayments, so once you've got a mortgage and you put them on weekly versus monthly, in other countries, it does make a difference. Like the more frequently you pay a normal payment. In Australia, I actually looked at this and I'm not going to mention the bank's name because I've gotten in trouble with them before. In Australia, one bank that also operates in New Zealand, if you change the exact same numbers and put it from monthly to fortnightly in Australia, you'll save 4 years in your mortgage. In New Zealand, do it on the same bank calculator, you save nothing. So it doesn't save any interest by going, for example, fortnightly instead of monthly or weekly instead of monthly. What saves interest is like making more payments regularly as extra payments, not the payment cycle.
Isn't it frustrating? Side note, the difference between Australia and New Zealand, you're just like, must be nice to have competition. If people do follow any of this advice or they sort of don't realize it's been outdated, they don't maybe talk to a professional like yourself, are there sort of life or lifestyle costs that can come into place if these myths don't get corrected or addressed?
It's probably more of a time opportunity cost kind of thing. Like that I'm saving for a 20% deposit. Takes me 3 years, house prices go up, I miss out. I need to wait 3 months until my bank statements are clean, or I need to wait until I've got a credit score. It just means that they're waiting and therefore there's potential opportunity costs that they're missing out on. Like the whole reason they usually speak to me is because they've seen a house they want to buy. And they're like, oh, hold on, I'm going to wait 3 months. So they miss out on the house and they find another house and then it may not have been the one they wanted kind of things. Hopefully they either speak to the bank or they speak to a mortgage advisor and they get corrected on that stuff before it becomes a actual real dollar cost to fix. Because, you know, if someone says to me, I want to pay weekly because it's going to save me interest, and I'm like, that's not a good idea because only one bank does that and this bank isn't going to be the best for you anyway. And then they're like, oh, thanks. You know, like there's just different things that they just aren't aware of.
And this is why I love that we get to have these conversations, these myth-busting conversations, because these myths creep up all the time. But I also am such a genuine believer in terms of even if someone goes out there and they see something from, you know, I've mentioned the US content creators, you know, and they get the wrong idea from that, but then that sparks a conversation with someone like yourself where they say, can I do this? And you say, nope. At least they had that conversation. You know, I'm such a big believer in that there are no stupid questions. Just get the question out there and figure it out, because you've got to get strategic somehow. You've got to start the conversation somehow. So it's so good that you then know, okay, well, you're interested in finding smart ways to save money on your mortgage. No, that doesn't work, but here's what does work. And I think that's so great. So in terms of once people have hopefully got into those homes and now you're saying, okay, here's how we're going to structure things. First of all, do you think it's worth it paying off the mortgage early?
Depends. So I guess going back to your home being a liability versus maybe what else you could do with the money, I think there's a very strong argument for if you know you've got a spare $1,000 per month, where is the best place to put it? Because, you know, you could pay it against your mortgage. Maybe you save 5% interest, which is pretty guaranteed, risk-free 5%, or same $1,000, you could go to the other end of the spectrum and think that maybe I'm going to put it in crypto and 10x it, but the risk of that is very, very big. And then you've got those other options in between, you know, managed funds, a term deposit, something like that. So if your goal is to have the best retirement and make heaps of money, then you need to think about what is your risk tolerance and where is that money going to make you more money. I think paying down your mortgage maybe isn't just a decision about what is financially best, but also people like having a mortgage-free property. Like, it's kind of a little bit of a brag, but also at the same time, you can be like, I don't have to worry about where I'm going to live in 20 years because I own this house outright. Being able to do that is more than, I think, a financial decision. I think it's more of like an emotional, like, yeah, cool, I can do this, it's retirement, whatever. Don't just put all your eggs in that basket though. Like, if you've got a spare $1,000 to do something with, maybe half of it goes on your mortgage and the other half you're investing somewhere else.
I so agree with what you're saying there. It's quite funny. You almost sound like you've got a stronger opinion on that than I do. And I'm so used to getting yelled at about this. I'm just like, bold that you're just saying it. But yeah, I so agree, because your own home is different from an investment property. And I think that is not talked about enough. Your own home is technically, as you just said, a liability. It's a cost. Now, is that a cost that's worth paying? I decided for me, yes, because everything you've just said, the stability, the security, I have locked in a price for that home that I then want to pay off as fast as I can. Once it is paid off, that is a huge cost savings. You know, I'm always going to want a roof over my head. It's still not an investment. It's still not making me money unless I bring in a boarder, which I don't want to. I'm happy to say I'm the problem. I don't like living with other people. My family are only barely allowed in there some days. I'm not bringing in a stranger too. And, you know, I want other things that generate income, for which I have things like shares. And that's a really important distinction, because having that cost savings is important for my retirement. Yes, it means I'm not having to pay out as much money, but I also still need cash in order to do things like take my grandkids out to the movies or take myself out, frankly. I'm hoping to have
a
nice
future. Do you have grandkids right now? Surely not.
Not yet.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But I have kids and I have plans for their future.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'm just making my plans.
Yeah.
Do you find that when you're talking to people, because you'd be talking to people about their home, about property all the time, that they are almost talking about it as the home as an investment? And do you almost have to break that to them sometimes as well?
Yeah, I think that the waters do get a bit murky sometimes. People are like, oh, I want to buy this house, but it's probably not going to go up in value. And I think, yeah, people need to look at it from different points of view. And there is, obviously you can buy a house that is a home that might be a better investment than others. So like, for example, you could buy a house that is run down, you could live in it, you could do it up, and then you could get it revalued and use the equity to buy an investment property. The problem is people sometimes buy a house that they like, nice kitchen, nice view, good area, and then they think it's a good investment. And maybe it is a good investment if they sell it, because in the future it might be worth more, but that ain't going to pay the bills while you're still living in it.
And you still have to buy somewhere else to live. You're probably not going to go and live under a bridge.
Yeah. You have to decide, are you buying for what you want, and emotionally, or are you buying what makes sense financially, or are you trying to get something in between? And if so, you're going to have to compromise.
So coming back to the paying off the mortgage earlier, because I got sidetracked, but that was fun. Are there good tactics that work majority of the situations? Like when you're having a conversation with someone, they say, I want to smash this mortgage as fast as possible. What are your sort of go-tos?
So at the beginning, after I've just bought a house, first time buyer, we're doing the loan structure meeting, I'd say do nothing. Because they've just bought a house, they have no idea how much it actually costs. They have no idea how much their mortgage costs, how much the insurance, or the council rates. So I just say, hey, once you get this house, don't worry, you're going to have a mortgage for 30 years. You can practice for the first 3 months. Just get used to what it costs you and how it changes your life. Then, if you think you've got spare money, here's three ways to pay off your mortgage. Number one, increase your regular repayments. So that means like instead of paying $500 per week, you maybe go $600 per week. Number two, make a lump sum every 6 months or every year. Number three, utilize offset accounts if they suit you and if you understand them. Because offset accounts, some people swear by them, some people love them, and some people just get confused by them. And you do not have to have an offset account to pay off a mortgage faster. You could easily just increase your you know, regular payments by $100 or $200 per week. And that's going to make a massive difference. That could save like a third off your mortgage just by paying an extra $100 depending on the mortgage size. And that is usually the easiest option because all you have to do is go onto the app. I'm going to pay $100 extra. Are you sure? Yes, yes, yes. Done. With the extra payment thing, and this is a very, I guess, another myth, again, probably from America, is like you have to make sure your extra payments go to principal and not to interest. In New Zealand, when you make a normal payment, assuming that your mortgage is principal and interest, which means part of the payment goes to the loan, the other part goes to interest, which is the fee the bank pays you, an extra payment will go 100% to the actual loan. There's no interest that's charged. The depressing thing about a normal payment is, especially when you've just got the house, 90% of that first payment's going to go to interest. So a $1,000 repayment, you're like, sweet, my $500,000 mortgage is going to go down to $499. No, it's going to go down to like $499,900. The rest is going to interest. But those extra payments, no interest, 100% principal. Same with the lump sums. And you just have to make sure that your bank is going to allow you to do so. And then if they want to go into offset accounts, it's like a whole nother can of worms, which I usually just say, get used to the mortgage. If you have an emergency fund right now, then let's talk about them. If you've just put all your money into the deposit and you've got hardly any money left over, then maybe get used to the mortgage and then we can understand whether or not it's going to work for you. Because offset accounts, do you have an offset account?
I do revolving, but yes, I mean, similar, same, different. I did not originally. It's funny actually, as you're saying this, you know, get used to having the mortgage first. I kind of accidentally followed your advice there because I was just a little baby journo at that point. and it was confusing to me. And I do think what you're saying there is beauty in simplicity. There are times when technically I think the numbers might be better doing something else. But if it confuses you or it makes you feel stressed or you're not entirely sure how to follow the system you've just created, the system that works is the system that's going to be best, right?
Yeah, you need to understand it.
Yeah.
And that conversation of offsets versus revolving credits comes up very often. And I think for those listening, the concept is very similar. The difference is maybe the bank that you're with, because not all banks offer offset accounts and not all banks offer revolving credits. And then there's like some that do both. But the principle is the same, is that if you've got money in your emergency fund earning you 1% in a savings account, maybe you choose to have your mortgage set up that most of it is on fixed, 50K is on like an offset account, and then you've got 50K in your emergency fund, you link them together, and instead of paying 5% interest on that offset money because it's linked, you're saving 5% interest. So you're thinking, oh, cool, that's pretty good. So it's as if you're paying a $50,000 less mortgage, but the best bit is you can still access the money if you need it. And that's where people don't really realize the cool thing is like, oh, well, why don't I just pay 50K off my mortgage? It's like, yeah, but don't you need that money sometimes? Like, don't you want a bit of a backstop? Like, oh, yeah. It's like, well, you can still use the money out of your offset account or out of your revolving credit. That's when you get charged interest. $10,000 out for a car, trip to Bali for a holiday, that's when you get charged interest. And then you're obviously going to set it up so that your pay goes back into that account, fills up that account up to the limit as much as possible, and then you save interest.
Yeah, the offset and the revolving, they can be so powerful if used right. So to my mind, I think if you're a little bit of a nerd, that often works. If you're someone who's been an absolute angel with debt, debt hasn't worried you, you've always had very good self-control with debt, you can treat a chunk of your debt almost like a savings account. So you can go really, really hard, no safety net needed, that's your safety net, really, really hard on paying off extra on your mortgage, be aggressive with that debt. Knowing that, you've got the backstop. If life takes a change or priorities change or whatever, you can say, whoopsies, takesies, backsies, and everything's fine. Whereas there is absolutely no takesies, backsies usually with paying off extra on the mortgage. And so it gives you that little bit of wiggle room, right? But pros and cons, like when you're talking to a client, what are sort of red flags, green flags of this person is good or not good for an offset or revolving?
Yeah, I think discipline is a big one, and maybe past history of debt, because you'll be surprised how many people have debt in New Zealand, short-term debt, before they've even bought a house. And the key thing that people probably miss is like you actually have to have money. So there's no point of having a 100K limit on your offset account if you've only got $10,000, because then you're going to be paying high interest on $90,000 that's not offset. And then actually, just like you said before, understanding how they work. I bought my first house probably 10 years ago. I had an offset account of $40,000, didn't understand it, got rid of it after 3 months. Now I have an offset account, fully understand it, saves me heaps of interest. Getting a mortgage is quite complicated from day one. Like, it's the biggest thing in the world when you've just got one. So you probably should just try and understand it. And maybe, like you said, simple is best for the beginning. You can always add one in later. So don't think that whatever you set up from day one of your mortgage structure, whether that's with me or whoever, is like that's what you're doing for the rest of your life. Like, your life is going to change. You're going to earn more money. You're probably going to spend more money if you start having children or something like that. And your structure should change with it.
Okay. So if people are listening to this and they're thinking, oh, I don't know if offset revolving sounds scary, confusing, but I like the idea of these making the extra payments or a lump sum. So how does all that work?
So obviously you have two choices, usually fix your mortgage, write your mortgage, or do a combination of both. And then if you want to add the offset account on top, then cool. If you're fixing a mortgage, then that's when the rules come in. If you're on floating, there's no rules, no limitations, no extra fees. You can kind of pay $1 a day on your mortgage if you really wanted to, or $10,000 and $50,000, no rules. The fixed rules is where the difference comes, and that comes from different banks as well. So some banks will do like a 20% of your minimum payment is what you can pay extra during fixed terms. Others do a 5%. Others would do like a fixed $250 per week is the max that you can do. So if you came to me and said, hey, I want to go with a bank which allows me to make the biggest extra payments I can during fixed terms, then we would obviously look at which one was going to suit that. Mm-hmm. So that allowance is important. And the way that you actually action it is you can just go onto your app. Most banking apps will just be like, make extra payments. The other option is a bit of a trick that you could just, so let's say you've maxed out your allowance on the fixed terms and you're not on any floating options. You could just wait until one of your portions goes on floating. So instead of refixing your mortgage after a year, don't. Wait a day, get it going floating. Do a big lump sum if you massively got like some sort of inheritance, or you, I don't know, want a scratchy or something like that. You could put it on that mortgage and then refix it the day after. And then you kind of get the best of both worlds. Yeah, you'll be surprised how much those extra payments actually add up over the years just by compounding. Like, we always talk about compound interest, and then the reverse of that when you've got debt, you know, interest is, you know, compounding the wrong way. But yeah, those extra payments just make a huge difference.
Well, it's wild. Like you said, any extra payment goes straight onto the amount you actually borrowed. So they're wildly more powerful than your standard payment that you are locked into that you have to do. I did a video a few weeks back on $20 extra a week, knocking, it was 5 years it knocked off the mortgage originally. And then I got my husband to match it. And between the two of us just doing $20 extra, that knocked 8 years off the mortgage. So that was nearly a quarter of the mortgage suddenly gone for this very small extra payment. Even though, you know, I was at the beginning of doing financial journalism, I kind of knew compound interest, but seeing it laid out that starkly, I was just like, whoa, you know, you get some compound interest involved and suddenly things are really cooking here. And you can get so far with such a small amount of money. Our brains just aren't wired for conceiving of the power of that little extra payment, right? Get a couple of $100 on there, you're going to be great.
Yeah, and 30 years is way longer than you think it is.
Little things done often are so much more powerful than waiting for one big silver bullet. If you can do a little thing regularly, you're going to get ahead way faster than waiting for your big solution. We've talked a lot about sort of structure, which is obviously the different account types and the different things you can do there. And I think a lot of people, when they message me, they're very focused on what's happening with interest rates. How can I get the best interest rate? Where are interest rates going? Should I fix? Should I float? Do you have thoughts on structure versus interest rates? Which one is more powerful?
I think you know the answer.
Hit me.
Yeah. So I get those messages as well. And I think in New Zealand, we have this unhealthy obsession with interest rates. you can't really change your interest rate. The bank is the bank. They set them. You could, you know, ask very nice and they might give you a cheaper one, 0.01, 0.05%. But your structure is so much more important. You know, like if you look at the interest rates that are available today and someone said to me, I want the cheapest rate at the moment is probably the 1 year rate, 4.49%. But what happens, because that's only 1 year out of 30 years of your mortgage, what happens when that 1 year is up? And if you've put your whole mortgage on that 1 year rate, what could happen in a year? If we go back to COVID times, the 1 year rate was 2.29%. People are like, oh my God, this is great. I'm going to put my $1 million mortgage all on 2.29% because that's the cheapest rate. Therefore, my mortgage is going to be cheaper. This is great. Fast forward a year, rates have gone from 2.29 to 5 point something. Their whole mortgage is now getting more than double of what their interest rate is. And that is when people started panicking and they were like, oh my God, I need to sell my house, but now I've got negative equity, blah, blah, blah. In hindsight, if they had maybe split their mortgage, 2.29% for maybe like a third of it, and then another third on the 3 year rate, which I think was 2.8 at the time, another third on the 5 year rate, which was 2.99 at the time, some of their mortgage probably still would be on 2.99%. So yes, it would have got more expensive, but gradually over 5 years, as opposed to all in 1 year. Loan structure is 100 times more important than just the cheapest interest rate. And reducing risk and trying to think about what could happen when your fixed terms come up is what your mindset should be. Not today, the cheapest interest rate. What is it going to be in 3 years? If that's what you're choosing, 100% on 3 years. I usually would say to someone, do not put all your mortgage on the same option because that's putting all your eggs in one basket. And we just don't know what the future holds. So by splitting a mortgage, whether it's halves or thirds, you're just reducing risk. I think that is a key thing, is reduce risk by splitting your mortgage.
Absolutely called out on that front as well, because those cheap interest rates, man. The economist, Tony Alexander, he put something out at that time and said, you know, this 5 year rate is insane. It's not going to stick around. Everyone should grab this right now. And of course, New Zealanders being obsessed with a 1 year rate, most of us didn't listen to him, myself included. I think I locked in a 2 year at that time. But I was like, oh, you know, I think it might go down a little more. And so after letting greed get the better of me, I then watched that 5 year rate sail away and was devastated. And I look back at that and I'm like, what made me think money was ever going to get cheaper than that? Like, that is incredible. But when you're in it, you don't see it. It is that benefit of hindsight. And so, like you say, having that structure, locking it in, and it sort of enforces that discipline. And then I, you know, adding in things like what we've talked about for ways to make easier extra repayments. If you do things like that, you can, with just these little tweaks on top of tweaks, get so much further ahead quite quickly, right?
Those people or anyone that pays like as if the interest rate was higher is always a good thing to be able to do, because it puts yourself in a position that if rates do get to that level, you know you're still going to be okay. The 30-year average in New Zealand for the 1 year rate is about 5.5. So like if you think you can afford a house on 5.5%, even if rates are lower, then you're probably going to be okay.
We've talked a lot about myths and misinformation. What about, are there any tactics out there that you would just ban tomorrow if given the opportunity?
I can see where you're going with this. auctions. We have way too many auctions in New Zealand. If you think about how auctions are used in other countries, they're usually for the derelict properties, the deceased estates, the houses that nobody wants. Whereas I feel like here in New Zealand, especially in Auckland, every house has to go to auction first before it gets passed in. And I like real estate agents,
but
not all of them, because some of them make my job harder. Some of them make it harder for a first home buyer. Some of them shouldn't be putting properties to auction because maybe they potentially could be leaky. Maybe they have unconsented works. Maybe there's more due diligence that needs to be done. And all they're doing is telling these first home buyers that they don't know better. If you want to get a pre-auction offer in, if you want a better auction, then cool, they might do this. But to get yourself in a position to better auction, for some people, it's $1,500. Building report, $500. Valuation, $1,000. And if you're going to spend that money, that's coming out of your deposit usually. And if you're a first home buyer, you probably don't have much money. You don't have money to do that five times. So you can understand why some first home buyers feel pretty disheartened when they miss out on properties because they're paying $1,500 every single time and a real estate agent might have got their hopes up. So I think auctions maybe need to be controlled better.
Yeah, but there's a lot of money involved and there's some great people working in the industry and there's some sharks. And I think it's always worth having the information that helps us tell the difference. Do you ever have people come to you and say, look, the mortgage is actually keeping me awake a bit at night? And if that does happen, what sort of things might have gone wrong? Like, are there any pitfalls here that we want to avoid, especially the sleep at night test? Because I just always think no money gain is ever worth it for just that constant low-level anxiety.
I think that happened a lot when we were talking post-COVID. Bought a house of 2.5% interest rate, went up. Oh my God, what am I going to do? The problem is that there is real stress versus perceived stress. And if you were getting a mortgage when rates were 2.5%, your mortgage was tested on 5.5% by the bank. So technically, if their financial position was the same, they can manage. The problem is when their financial position changes. So a lot of times would be, we want to buy a house because we're pregnant. That is usually where the stress would come from. I think just interest rates going from 2.5% up to 5% definitely makes people uncomfortable, but it's not one of those things where, like, you know, they should be aware rates can go up, you know, and I think some people are a little bit ignorant to that fact. But let's just say maybe you've lost your job and you're thinking, okay, how am I going to pay my mortgage? The bank, believe it or not, doesn't actually want to sell your property. To them, a mortgagee sale is like the last resort.
It's a pain in the butt for them as well.
Yeah. And they will work with you for years to help you. So if you're on a principal and interest mortgage, the first thing they're probably going to offer you is interest only, which would mean that instead of paying the principal part, you're just paying the interest, which is slightly cheaper. If that doesn't work or that's still too expensive, then they'll give you a mortgage holiday. Maybe that starts off at 3 months of no mortgage payments at all. But you have to be very mindful that interest is still being charged on your mortgage.
Yeah, you're building up a bigger debt.
They're not just being like, yeah, just pause it. It's like you're still getting a current interest. So you have to be aware of that and don't just do that as a easy out kind of thing. So they'll give you a mortgage holiday. And as long as you respond to their emails, you know, you'd get put into a special team and they'd like look after you. As long as you're trying to make payments or make some kind of payments, they'll likely keep working with you until you get yourself in a better position. I think people don't need to be fearful that their house is going to be sold if they can't make their mortgage because most people can find another job. Most people will be able to pay something towards their mortgage.
Mm. If there was an easy win that you could get almost everyone to lock in, what would that be?
An extra $100 a week in your mortgage. You can even just see how much it's going to save you before you commit to it because the bank is going to say that. Put it on the app and see how much time it's going to save you. Another trick would be if interest rates drop, keep your repayments the same as when they were higher. It's pretty much the same thing. It's not going to make a difference to your bottom line or your everyday living or anything like that.
Love that. So agree as well. All right. Aaron Cattell, the mortgage man, where can people find you if they want more of your amazing words of wisdom?
Instagram, themortgage_man, TikTok, which is where I started, I guess. YouTube as well. And there is a podcast, not as good as this one, that you can listen to, is basically me interviewing past clients and professionals that help people buy. The other thing that's really helpful for first home buyers, especially is the First Home Buyer Academy, which is a free course that I created that you can just go to my Instagram or TikTok, download it. It's about 40 videos of like, here's how you buy a house. Here's how you pay a mortgage. just to give people a little bit more knowledge, because obviously it's something that a lot of people have never done before.
Thank you so much for that and all the good info you put out on there. Now, if this helped you, then first of all, hit subscribe to Making Sense wherever you are listening to this, and then send this episode on to a friend so we can all level up our money together. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.